I just can't have any social life right now.
Don't worry about it. We're just having coffee. We'll be antisocial.
Welcome, listeners, to another Damn Fine Espresso. This time I'm joined by Julie. Hey, Julie.
Hello.
After listening to your main episode in our summer series of genres about Westerns, Julie, you talked to Matt and to Dan Thron, our regular guest of the show, and it was such an interesting conversation, really epic and intriguing and really getting to the depths of, you know, this iconic genre that is so much about our images of America, of history, of movie history. And I have to admit, I'm not a big Western guy. It's probably one of the genres that I would choose least when I have a movie night and I'm going through all the genres that are offered on all the streaming services, I would probably choose the Western the least. So I had questions, Julie. But thanks for sharing your enthusiasm about Westerns so much. I'm wondering, did you also watch a lot of like Western on television as opposed to like Western movies?
Well, yes, but in terms of movies, so the American series, the Western series, Bonanza and Maverick and so on, right?
Right.
They're really famous. Not so much, just intermittent. Not just past the generation that turned the TV on every week for, you know, your weekly episode of the installment of Bonanza. So mostly movies and mostly old movies and sometimes really, really, really terribly terrible movies. Yeah.
I think I also came by way of television, but just seeing, you know, like flipping through channels and then you'd see these images of the saloon and the sheriff and the lonesome cowboy and all these like tropes. And for me, it was a little bit like I almost wanted to switch channels immediately because it almost seemed like the same thing over and over again. And it seemed very like extremely typified. I would never stop and think, oh, let me see what happens now in the saloon, or let me see what happens now in this upcoming duel. And I think it had a lot to do with this like serial going through the motions of especially television. So I wonder if my dislike of Westerns kind of stems more from there than from actual movies.
Well, it depends on how you approach it. I mean, in the main episode, we very much focused on the Western as a way of storytelling. So not so much in terms of, okay, you have the sheriff is in town, you have the bad guy and people shooting people up in the saloon and there are maybe some sex workers, though they're never called that, right? It is a way of storytelling and a cinematic grammar that really came to us via Westerns, partly because of the directors that made Westerns in our film history, who were very brilliant, and partly because they're so old. They go back to all the way back to Thomas Ince in the beginning of Hollywood, in which they were just basically very lucrative. You just get some people on horses. Can you ride a horse? Yeah, okay, let's go, right? You have a lot of chases and there you go. It's a wrap. You have a movie. So there is a big influence, I think, on a storytelling grammar that the Western had on films that we might not now call Westerns. I mean, Dan was very sort of broad in terms of that. If you look at a particular film grammar, you know, almost everything becomes a Western in terms of also of visual grammar. But if you are more restricted and you say, okay, look, I define a Western by that it talks about the American frontier or the Australian frontier or, you know, a frontier, then you get into what then belongs to that genre, right? It's the same, like people have asked me often to define the horror genre. Right. When is something a thriller? When is it a horror? It's, I think it's more a kind of visual grammar that you're talking about than how many people die. And does that make it? Right. The body count makes it either an action movie or, you know, it doesn't work that way, right?
Well, it seems to be the genre that is most like where most people can agree on these like key ingredients, right? It's like seems to be, like you said, the grammar is not just the locations and what happens, but also which figures, which archetype need to be in that kind of setting, what the plot arc is going to be, good versus evil. And like you said, the frontiers are kind of in the development of some new world expansion, the sense of adventure. I think I really liked in the episode also how you touched upon, you know, science fiction, you touched upon the cop thriller, you touched upon Rambo in the 80s. So it seemed like it's very translatable as well. And I guess every kid who's ever played at one point must have played, you know, cowboys and sheriff or villain duels somewhere.
Bandits. Cowboys and bandits.
Cowboys and bandits and must have dressed up at some point as Western characters. So it seems like the grammar or the assembly of things in a movie or in a show that everybody seems to be agreeing upon most easily.
Right. And of course, Westerns are a very grateful subject for ridiculing as well.
Exactly. Exactly. I think, you know, playing with these elements, I think that's a big part of where Westerns seem to be, in a great place to as a subject. And we brought one movie to the table that for me kind of as a, not as an anti-Western person, but as a person who never came through movies by the way of Western so far until I saw, you know, Once Upon a Time in the West by Sergio Leone. I think that was when my love for movies started, actually, even though I never much got further into Westerns except for the Italian Westerns. But another genre that really helped was the spoof comedy. And I think the movie we're going to talk about is Blazing Saddles by Mel Brooks. And Mel Brooks, to me, I think I told you at the beginning before our conversation, in a way was a way into many movie genres by way of just the spoof. So you saw the spoof of Star Wars, Spaceballs, and you saw the spoof of, I think, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Men in Tights, and so on. So sometimes I had seen the spoof before I actually saw the actual movie. And then, of course, I only understood all the references and so on. So Blazing Saddles, we thought that would be a great opportunity to see, well, what is it that Mel Brooks does with Blazing Saddles here? Had you seen the movie like many times over before?
I had seen it multiple times, but it's not one of those things that you keep returning to. I think it's one of the better ones that Mel Brooks has done in terms of payoff. It's one of the messier ones, so it's really hard to sort of keep up with. But yeah, I think I sort of absorbed it. I mean, it's so famous and it is really kind of everywhere. And like you say, also with the Men in Tights one, you sort of have to go see it. I mean, it's a staple, I think, of your cinematic diet, even if it's not quite your... And particularly with comedies, it's difficult, I think, because it has to do with whether they land or not. And that's really individual. I remember this thing where I was still living in Amsterdam. We had this projector on loan to watch movies on the wall. And we chose Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, so the Val Kilmer one. And I was in stitches, like throughout. I thought it was just the most hilarious thing. And my friends who were watching it with me were looking at me like, there's something wrong with this woman. They didn't get it at all. It just didn't land for them. And they thought it was crass and they thought it was, you know. And I just thought it was the most hilarious thing. And I think the same goes with Mel Brooks. It's like on the one hand, there are moments that you're in absolute stitches. And there are parts where you're like, this is just a muddle. And also, and I have to get this out of the way before we continue this conversation. This movie was made in 1974, I think.
Exactly.
The slurs. As a viewer from 2026, the slurs are hard to take. I know how they are meant. I know that this is a sort of, it is a given that this racism is horrible, but just my ears started ringing from these slurs. I was like, oh boy, this is a bit much. So maybe I'm just a snowflake. But I thought that was pretty hard to take. And it sort of did distract from the comedy of it because you're like, ooh, do you have to use the N-word so many times, right?
Yeah, and it's so famous for it, right? But I think it's almost the reverse right now, watching it from a 2026 perspective than it was intended, right? It was supposed to expose all that crass racism of these people and kind of bring it to the open. And using the word was kind of, I guess at the time, was kind of like a liberating laugh to have it exposed as much. And today, of course, where such language has been restricted so much to just, you know, just that the crassest right wingers will use it. It rubs you the wrong way at first.
It's hard to take.
At first, I was like, wow, really? In the first two scenes where it appeared. And then by the time, of course, the sheriff arrives in town and they really play around with it, you know, with a gong going off each time someone says it. I mean, it's still hilarious, but I think you need the context of when the movie came out and what it meant in 1974, and of course, within a context of Mel Brooks poking fun at it and coming at it from his own comedy perspective after The Producers and after Young Frankenstein, where he had, you know, already like pushed the envelope, like pushed the boundaries of comedy.
Right, with The Producers, yeah. That one to me is more hilarious even than Blazing Saddles, just because it's so painful. It's just painful.
I think, yeah, the pain he inflicts, right, is part of the secret. But yeah, to us, you know, I would say growing up as a teenager without much internet yet, I think watching films by Mel Brooks that pushed these boundaries so much. I mean, it was really the talk among the kids after we had seen a movie and passing around these videotapes with especially Blazing Saddles. I also, I think, watched like Spaceballs and High Anxiety like that. You know, these were iconic scenes that you would then kind of reenact and like quote endlessly in, of course, the dubbed German version, because they were like mind blowing to us that this could be in a movie. Especially, I remember the bean scene, you know, the cowboys sitting by the fire and just flatulating for like 3 minutes on end.
I know.
This was our favorite scene, you know. We would say, oh yeah, the scene with the beans. And then everybody would know what it was. So he was kind of our secret hero because he would go beyond all these boundaries that I guess our parents and school and all the adults had said, and we were like, oh my God, there are these movies out there where you can see and hear all of that. And it was, you know, it was great to us at the time.
I was interested in how you came back to it, because as I watched this movie for the podcast, there's one particular scene that just really struck me, and it's Gene Wilder having this really funny monologue against his friend who's black about these people. These are people from the clay and these are people from the country. And, you know, there's basically, and his word is morons. And our sheriff just loses it. And I'm like, this is a blown take. They blew the take. He just can't keep it together. And they kept it in. And this scene gives such warmth to this film. This is a friendship, a real friendship. And I'm so glad they kept that, because the movie needs a little warmth, I think, a little affection. Otherwise, we'll just, I don't know, be counter to everything he's trying to do. And then there's the second scene, which I'm afraid I burst out laughing. There is a Native American chief who speaks in what is meant to be broad Yiddish about saving the African-American family, right? Let them go. And this is an in-joke, right? This is something I would never have realized when I first saw the movie. This is an in-joke where Hollywood used to hire, you know, Jewish actors for everything that was maybe remotely ethnic or anything, right? So this is a huge sort of raspberry to old Hollywood, which I could appreciate now, but didn't then. And with the other scene as well, but I think that it was a blown take, but he has the balls to keep that, because he knows it's just important to have a little bit actual feeling in the movie. It's worth watching out for. I really enjoyed that they sort of said, no, leave that, even though you can clearly tell it's a blown take. You know, just leave it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I think coming back to it, I think I realized that probably, as it's such a, like you said initially, it's a mess of a movie, right? There's like so much in it, so many ideas. At certain times, it becomes very slow and kind of a little tedious to watch. And then there's like great stuff in it again. I think at the time, I must have just enjoyed whatever I did understand. And then there's a lot that I had no idea about. And I think it was also lost in a dubbing. I don't think, you know, the Yiddish speaking chief made any sense. He was probably speaking some other dialect. I don't remember. I'd have to check with the German dubbing how they worked in that joke, if they even got it when they were translating it.
Probably not.
Probably not. I mean, there's a lot of things in Mel Brooks that I think kind of doesn't make sense, and probably still doesn't make sense to me watching it now. But of course, there's enough to enjoy and appreciate and maybe understand anew. I think it was also a way, and I think that goes back to our discussion of genres, it was also a way of understanding the stereotypes before really seeing the original in any of the genre that he spoofed. You know, be it the Dracula, Dead and Loving It, before I actually saw Bram Stoker's Dracula. It was like hilarious to then see like Francis Ford Coppola's version, because it was like, it's the same hair, it's the same line, and so on. How close they had been in certain moments to the original. And just to understand also, what are they spoofing? How do they perceive the kind of old and tired ways that a Western would be built up, or the conflict would play out? But I think what I enjoyed about Mel Brooks is that it was always surrounded by really good players that were having a ball making this. You know, I think Gene Wilder is great in this.
He's wonderful in this.
But I also love Harvey Korman and Madeleine Kahn. They're in every second Mel Brooks movie.
Madeleine Kahn is smashing in this.
One iconic scene and then a couple of small moments. But she, I mean, she was nominated for the Oscar for this. She was like so memorable.
Genius.
As this like pseudo Marlena Dietrich. And she does it so well that I think these are like just like scene stealing, show stealing moments. And you kind of forgive the fact that the entire movie as a whole really does not gel, right? It's like a lot of pieces. You can also walk away from the movie for a couple of minutes and come back to it. It's more like a, and I think that goes back to where Mel Brooks comes from. It's kind of like a comedy program.
Right.
Could be a vaudeville show, anything that you could see just on a simple stage with few players and very few props. And it would be the same jokes and it would be just as funny. And the fact that he made this like massive Panavision technical, you know, what they're displaying right at the beginning to make this like expensive Western out of it is, I think, a joke in itself, which I enjoy.
Absolutely. Look, let's get a little bit personal, do full disclosure. What I love most about Mel Brooks films, and this goes for nearly all of his, are the musical numbers.
Yes.
I will just never forget History of the World and the Inquisition, and him being a stand-up philosopher, not comedian. And, you know, these musical, and again, in Blazing Saddles, Madeleine Kahn, who is so tired of all these men wanting to have sex with her. It's just very fatiguing. I mean, these things, if you forget the rest of the movie, right, which you don't because everybody is absolutely grand in it, whether it's a mess or no, everybody's beautiful in it. But those things will really stick with you, right? Robin Hoodman in tights as well. I think Carrie Elwes is lovely in this, but also the little number where they sing, "We're Men in Tights," "Manly Man in Tights." It's just something, whether you enjoy it or no, whether it makes you laugh or no, it will certainly stick with you. I mean, and one film, you know, sort of lands better than the other film. I mean, I think that's a given. I think that's always the case, independent on whether it's, you know, one is better than the other. And as I said, maybe Saddles is not the one that immediately gets to me in that way, again, because of the many, many slurs, and I'm not used to it. And it sort of distracts me from the entire thing. But the little musical number with the actors in the top hats, it has nothing to do with anything, and it's just beautiful. And one of my favorite bits of Saddles is the ending, where they ride off into the sunset and then they get a limousine to step into to ride further off into the sunset, which I thought was very sweet, very affectionate. But I like them. I think they're at their best when they have a little bit of affection for film and a little bit of affection for their characters. And that's just not always there, I think.
And I think you touch on two things. I think Mel Brooks' love for cinema and cinema history is very important to understand these, right? They are spoofs, but they're also lovingly made and made with a lot of effort.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm thinking, you know, this was really made like a proper Western, and they had Frankie Lane singing the title song. They're really going for the locations, the battles. There's no dollar spared here. And I'm reminded also of, you know, when he made Young Frankenstein. What did he do? He got all the props back in, the whole set from the original James Whale Frankenstein, and he filmed the creation scene in the same set. So there's such a love for the originals that it's a loving spoof.
In the best moments it is, I think. And I think it's very true what you say. He takes comedy very seriously. I mean, History of the World, we forget, but I think that has a voiceover by Orson Welles.
It does, yes, yes.
And all those things just by themselves are fantastic, aren't they? I mean, these are Easter eggs for nerds.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's what also allows him to then genre bend as much at the end. And I think it's also a really, really famous element, what you mentioned in Blazing Saddles, when suddenly they change from one set to the other and they have this musical number going on with the top hats and this
beautiful
French Mistake song. And I mean, in a way, it is about genre at the end, to come back to this like summer of genre, because he kind of like bends it and then takes you out, you know, breaks the fourth wall a couple of times, and then they go to see their own movie before jumping in back into the movie. And then you come back to that limousine moment that you mentioned and riding off to the sunset. So it's like, at the end, it's a little mind-blowing what he does, because he really asks for a lot, even for someone watching comedy, to go back and forth between, are we in the movie? Are we out of the movie? Is it a spoof about filmmaking? Is it really the story that we just saw? Or is it something completely different? That, I think, is also great. And the music.
The music is lovely.
I think that's the second thing. I think, you know, I only realized, and I know I'm big on film music, but I think only realizing later that John Morris, who's the composer of most of Mel Brooks's films, really is a key ingredient in why these work, because he also takes the genre seriously. He doesn't write spoof music. He writes the music very, very seriously in terms of like the musical vernacular and, you know, the style, the instrumentation. Young Frankenstein had a great score. And even though the lyrics of these songs, like I'm Tired or Springtime for Hitler and so on, are hilarious, but the music, like the way they're built up, they're like fully fledged Western score, fully fledged horror score. And for the Hitchcock one, High Anxiety, you know, it's really like suspense music with a couple of references to, I don't know, Jaws and Psycho. Obviously, you have to, but it's serious, right? It's really made from A to Z. They don't spare anything to say, well, it's just cheap comedy. No, it's comedy made with all the effort necessary.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's interesting because it's sort of very influential as well. In terms of when you go to the better of the Will Ferrell comedies, they're very different in many ways, but they also have this idea that you throw everything at them. Something in this comedy is just taken very earnestly for what it is. For example, they did this NASCAR comedy with Will Ferrell. I think it's called Talladega Nights. It's a very cute comedy. It really is cute. But it also has like the actual NASCAR commentators who play the actual NASCAR commentators in a comedy about NASCAR, that sort of thing, right? So, and I think, I'm not sure, but he must have been influenced by comedies like Mel Brooks's, who seems to just be taking the pee out of everything, but he takes what he does extraordinarily seriously to almost a point where it's, you almost forget, right? You think this is this sophomoric little comedy, but it really isn't. It takes its stuff very seriously. And it has all these classic Hollywood jokes. And another example, Blazing Saddles again, where we get this entire sort of excursion into musicals and cinemas and Hollywood. And, you know, it's all very messy. And then we return back to the Western setting. So our sheriff comes back into the Wild West and meets up with his friend just before they walk off into the sunset together. And his friend, Gene Wilder, has a bucket of popcorn left over from the cinema they just left to re-enter the movie that they're playing in, right? It's so cute. And I really enjoy that sort of stuff. Even though the fart jokes are not entirely my thing, that sort of thing just lands it for me. I'm like, okay, that is adorable. That is really, really, really cute.
That one's for the kids, you know, that one's for the kids. So he seems to kind of give you fun for the whole family. And I think in a way, consciously having a few things in there that only the Hollywood, classic Hollywood fans will understand, or stuff that is just slapstick or just laugh out loud funny, or might just be a bit too childish. I think that's why it's such a mess. It's such a mix. It's such a wild program that doesn't really come together as a whole. And you say, well, this was a great movie. I think you don't feel that way, but you probably remember a lot of the moments and the little jokes and sometimes snickering at just something that you understand new each time you watch it. And I think coming back to it, so after such a long time with Blazing Saddles, I had a sense of like, I should probably get back into a couple of these Mel Brooks movies and the spoof comedy that seemed to be so in fashion during the 70s and 80s. You know, I was also growing up with, of course, The Naked Gun.
Yes.
Which also took a page out of Mel Brooks, and obviously Airplane that had preceded it.
Both hilarious, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. One of my favorite comedies must be the original Naked Gun and the original Airplane. But I think they had their time, right? They seemed to end a little bit at the beginning of the 90s, and maybe, I don't know, that says something about...
No, later, I think.
Or a little bit in the decade of the 90s, where Mel Brooks was still making them. But I wonder, they got lost somewhere along the way. And I'm wondering, even though they rebooted Naked Gun last year, and there's going to be a second Spaceballs coming out next year, apparently, I wonder if the spoof comedy has a future. I guess Scary Movie just had another one added.
I think it's interesting to pose like the question, right? Because you say the 90s, I think it was even a little bit later that just these comedies just didn't seem to land somehow. What I do remember is that they made a comedy just after 9/11, and the first one they came up with was Zoolander back then. The reason I remember that is not because it's a particularly sort of groundbreaking comedy, but because it must have been a difficult decision to make also tone-wise, right? When and how are you able to do these rollabout laughing things after such an event? So I don't know, maybe it's partly societal, and maybe also we just lost our taste for it. I mean, audiences change. Maybe we now think we went through a lot of these very dark comedies remember those, right? I cited Kisses Bang Bang, which is relatively recent, but also these very sort of dark satires. We had one of my favorites, American Psycho, which I don't think you can call it comedy per se, because it's not. But these sort of very rather darker stories that have a comical element, at least. So maybe they just fell out of fashion.
Yeah. Interesting thought also concerning 9/11, maybe these watershed moments where things started to become much more serious. And I'll remember also in, you know, blockbuster cinema, suddenly Jason Bourne seemed to be the style of what action thrillers should be, much more gritty, much darker. And maybe such comedies like Mel Brooks produced like for 2-3 decades, maybe they also fell out of fashion because these tastes also changed. And you thought, well, just a plain old spoof, kind of like a lightweight, self-referential comedy is not the thing people want to see. But it's interesting how, in a way, for me, that was like almost like a genre of its own. We could probably have a full episode about like spoof comedies of that era and how they somehow disappeared. And now watching them again, I'm thinking, oh yeah, that's really the type of humor that I grew up on. And I guess I learned a lot through it also, again, about movies, about references to movies that I understood through or by way of comedy. But yeah, they had their particular time. Blazing Saddles probably came out, I think, just shortly after Young Frankenstein. So kind of at the pinnacle of this, or when these were really in fashion.
And in a way, I missed that era because I was born much later than that. I absorbed them well after they came out. And in a way, not to make these really false analogies, but in a way, it's like you grow up with Mel Brooks in the way that you grow up with Laurel and Hardy. In that they're iconic and they're also almost inevitable. Like they were always a part of history for you. Now, this is my, I realize that it's my problem for not being born earlier, but it's also, you reference them in a different way than the stuff that came out. Like Clerks, for instance, right? Those types of comedies, those types of sort of loser comedies that actually came out when were pretty formative for me, in terms of how you read cinema. These were just seem to have been always there, even though you know they're not, right? You are perfectly cognizant of that they were made in a particular time, but they just seem to be such a given for me that they were always part of cinema. I don't know how to explain it better.
Yeah, I hope for generations now growing up with movies that they also have this, because I think comedy especially, I guess, is also a safe genre, right? You can watch films in a row, you can kind of get the jokes, learn a little bit about language and puns and double entendres and slapstick and what's funny, what's not. I think teenagers should always have a type of comedy to, I don't know, learn from is maybe a bit too highbrow, but kind of to absorb things about how the world works. And I think Mel Brooks, as you say, was a certain type of comedy that did that, as were the classics like Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy and so on as well, where you kind of understood a little bit more than just about a joke. It's also about what's funny, what's not, what types of jokes there are. So I hope there are as instructive comedies these days as well for people growing up, because I think it was quite a gift. And for me as a movie buff, I almost think that helped a little bit also getting into all kinds of movie-related things, because you had all these references and you wanted to find out what they were all about, what the joke was all about. So I think, yeah, thanks to Mel Brooks, I think that was really something that was open to me.
Yeah, and also to take us a little bit back to the beginning, he also has a very good eye for a certain type of cinematic language. So even if you, in a manner of speaking, looks at them with the sound off, the way that he uses, that he references a certain cinematic language is also instructive. He just knows a great deal about film.
Definitely.
So that's also interesting. They are, however, abrasive. They are, at least in little snippets, their love letters. If not for anything else, for musicals, I think he loves music. He must love musicals so much. And I've really enjoyed the song and dance numbers. I think they are exquisite in their way. But it's also a way, I think, of speaking in certain grammar. If you're talking about spoof or pastiche or making fun of a genre which you may or may not even enjoy, it also has to do with the pure visuals of it. So the landscapes and the fact that it's a set is also a joke in itself. They make a movie set in the movie, which then becomes a movie set. And so on and so forth. These are all very sort of lovingly knitted together, even though just put on a big old pile, they may not gel for you, right? So there just a lot goes into them, and I appreciate that. And I have a hard time thinking of a modern comedy which is quite so involved in that way with what it's doing. So yeah, there is a bit of admiration there that you just put that work into it, and never mind, you know, if people like it or laugh or don't laugh, you know that you put all of that in there. I think that's something, there's something to be said for that by itself.
Yeah, that's beautifully put, I think. So we appreciate Mel Brooks for being an instructor in all things cinema, someone so knowledgeable and has such a love for things and puts that in, out there with all the foibles and all the things that don't work anymore. But it's still a great show. And I think it gives us a lot of insights into how cinema works. So listeners, if you have a chance to seek out more Mel Brooks comedies or just one or the other, why not start with Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, History of the World, Part 1, and see for yourselves. And even if not everything lands, but I think it might be an interesting insight into the genres that we're also discussing this summer.
And you can always ignore all the boob jokes because they are ever present.
as so many. So everybody will find their problematic, most problematic joke area probably in there. But that's part of the game. Anyway, Julie, thanks so much for talking to me about this as a non-Western fan yet, but I think it's like opera or whiskey. Maybe you'll get into it later in life. So I keep my hopes up. And after listening to the main episode, which I highly recommend to our listeners, I'm pretty sure I will get more into the Western genre.
Well, I hope you know, primarily that you find some that you can enjoy, because it's a really, really, really broad genre. And there's a lot in there to enjoy for practically any taste.
I see a lot of chances for second chances also maybe later on.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, join us for another episode of our Summer of Genres. There's more in the works. And of course, join us for any episode and another damn fine espresso as well. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.